right. How you doing? This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC. 844-753-7842. I'm a little bit weird today. Because
today?
Yeah, today. Because I don't really have so much of a sleep schedule so much as I've got a sleep disaster going on. I don't know else how to describe it. My name is Sam Olvey. With me today is Rebecca Friedman. How are you?
I am rested.
Fantastic. And joining me in for the first part and the last part is Dan Lombardo. How are you?
You know, I'll take up the middle on your spectrum here. We've got the no rest, the well rested. I'm right in between.
Fantastic. All right. So there may be some sanity in this episode. Who knows? But you're not going to find sanity in the South. I've got a oh, boy. I don't even know where to begin in this one. A Mississippi group is gathering signatures for an initiative that would establish Christianity as the state's religion. Initiative 46 will amend the state's constitution in numerous ways, including declaring the state principally Christian, requiring public school children recite a state pledge of allegiance acknowledging an almighty God. The amendment would also make English the official state language, declare permissible mascots for state colleges, and establish April as Confederate Heritage Month. The petition needs 100,000 signatures to get Initiative 46 on the ballot. I believe it also establishes meth as the state dish, too.
Possibly. Let's hope that there are not 100,000 people that are constitutionally inept.
I also believe it makes owning Beatles records a stoning offense.
Yes. I don't know. So, Sam, do you want to hear this state pledge?
Oh, you have the pledge?
I do have the pledge. Oh, it would force me to recite it, though, on air. So I'm not sure how comfortable I feel with that, but...
All right. Start, and I may tell you to stop.
I salute the flag of Mississippi and the sovereign state for which it stands with pride in her history and achievements and with confidence in her future under the guidance of Almighty God.
Jeez.
And this would be any time that the Pledge of Allegiance to, you know, the flag of the United States of America is recited, it would be that all public school children would have to then follow it up with this other pledge.
Well, in any state where you have a lot of direct democracy, and Washington State is one of those states, don't get me wrong, you always have a few people who show up with wackadoodle stuff that just doesn't make any sense. And I kind of hope this is one of those. But every time I kind of hope that from the American Southeast, I am proven so wrong, so desperately wrong. I don't know. My hope is that this just won't find traction, because this just goes just short of saying, hey, you know, getting rid of slavery was a bad idea. Why don't we bring that back?
Yeah, the part about this one that interests me is where it says it will declare permissible mascots for state colleges.
In the Constitution?
It's right here in the text. Yeah. So how important is it to declare permissible mascots for the state of Mississippi colleges?
And
what mascots are off limits or are approved that would not otherwise be approved?
Well, here's the thing. The initiative is a celebration of Mississippi's heritage. And so it's saying, look, what we're worried about is that someone sometime will say, hey, you can't wave the Confederate flag at your state, football games because it's highly offensive and harkens back to a time in our history where we decided that humans weren't actually humans. I mean, that's the thing. And it's saying, for the purposes of mascots for sports competitions, this is our mascot, and the likeness shall never be impinged, and the right to wave the flag and sing its song is not, you know, will always be protected as part of our heritage.
So we're going to have, like, Grouchy the Dixie flag as the state college mascot or something?
It's similar. It's old Reb. It's the rebel.
Right.
Oh.
So can we get back to, there's one thing that we talked about in the pre-show that I never got answered for me. Part of this initiative, it reestablishes the state borders of Mississippi. And unless they're shrinking the borders, that could go really bad really fast. Did we figure out which way the borders are going in this case?
So per my research, it looks like in 1990, the state changed how the borders were defined and left that to the legislature. And this would bring back the original sort of definition of where the borders were, which was by a commission in the late 1800s.
Okay, so this is just somebody's thing that they keep pushing just because they're politically weird.
And they tie it to heritage.
Yeah, and to get this group of people on board, they just sort of throw that in the amendment.
I think so. From what I could gather, it looks like it's something having to do with where exactly along the Mississippi River your state ends, whether it's in the middle of the river or east or west.
The Mississippi River, to its credit, or to some logical credit somewhere, does tend to move.
It does.
There's a town in Illinois that used to be on the east side of the Mississippi River that is now on the west side of the Mississippi River, and it was briefly in the Mississippi River. Interesting story about my home state that maybe we'll talk about at some point. But we need to move on, and I'm looking forward to watching this one.
If it passes, you can't establish a state religion.
We could go on about this one forever about why it's dumb. I'd like to give some humans a little bit more credit about that. I think you can figure out. In fact, contact me and tell me why it's wrong. Don't make me say it, because I think it's kind of obvious. A little less obvious is the Catholic Church. The Fort Wayne South Bend Diocese of the Catholic Church claims that their right to religious freedom should grant them exemption from being sued. The diocese is being sued for sex-based discrimination in the firing of a teacher who was seeking IVF treatment. When the judge agreed to hear the case, the diocese appealed that decision to the Seventh Circuit Court, claiming that going to trial would deny the school the benefits of religious protection. The diocese claims that they are not only exempt from discrimination laws based on Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, but they are even exempt from having to go to court at all.
I don't really know what to do with this one. So if you're exempt from going to court, how do you decide whether or not you're exempt from going to court? Do you roll a D4 and see what comes up?
What I think is what usually happens when someone decides I'm not going to show up in court. When it's a civil suit, you know, it usually falls to the to the complainant. It's usually falls to the in favor of the person who is filing the suit.
Right.
And I'm not sure what the diocese is thinking here, what their angle is. I mean, I think that it's right there and there. We are denied the benefit of religious protection. This is, you know, we do have religious freedom. We have freedom from the establishment of a state religion and the state officially endorsing a religion. But it doesn't mean that just because you are religious, you are free from any kind of civil code or conduct.
But this is essentially saying that the Catholic Church is above the law. That, according to the Catholic Church, it could show up and murder your entire family, thus beginning the newest Steven Seagal film, and it would be okay.
Still making films?
I hope so.
See a renegade priest in this one.
He had a reality show for a while where he was like a cop.
He was, yeah.
That's
he
true.
Was
he was deputized.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was a weird one.
But I agree with you. This thinking that you're above the law, where does that end? If you think that you're above civil suit, do you think that you're also above criminal prosecution?
Right.
I mean, clearly we do, since we've seen a history of the Catholic Church saying we're going to shield, we're going to shield abusers from criminal prosecution and, relocate them, all kinds of things like that.
Right, right. And this brings me to a thing that I bring up every now and again, which is at some point the Catholic Church is going to have to decide whether or not it's a religion or a country, because they're basically saying they're above the law. And when this happens at the Vatican level, they usually make some sort of noise. And if they keep pressing this, this is where it's going to go, that because the Vatican is its own state, they deserve some sort of, extraterrestrial or extrajudicial or whatever. I prefer, it is extraterrestrial if you think about it. Whenever people start doing things like treating them like a country, they go, no, we're a religion. How dare you turn your back on the people in your country? And I think at some point, they're going to have to pick. Because if you're a country, then all of your churches are embassies, and I can kick you out of them.
Your consulate has now reached the point of no welcome in this particular sovereign nation, so go back to your own sovereign nation.
Right. And once upon a time, this was the very argument which formed, back when Catholics were called Papists or things like that. This was actually a point of discrimination, which makes it very strange to me that the Catholic Church would then turn around and use this in order to get around molesting children or sexual harassment or bad hiring procedures. This is ridiculous to me. Why go to that well? Why not just do what everybody else on earth does, or it has to do, by the force of law, which sometimes means by the force of arms, and go to court? Why is this so difficult?
The other thing here is that they are immensely out of touch with their populace, with their followers. I mean,
at least in the United States.
At least in the United States. That is whom I'm speaking of. This is, you know, there's many cases that are now being brought by teachers being fired for having legally married their partner because they happen to be a same-sex partner, for seeking to become pregnant outside a marriage, right? For all of those kinds of things, for accessing contraceptive services and contraceptive, you know, medications, all of those kinds of things. This is popping up all over the United States, and about 70% of Catholics are in favor of those kinds of allowances for letting people get married, for letting people determine their own, you know, birth and fertility, kinds of things.
But in the parts of the world where the Catholic Church has a lot more political sway than they do here, the landscape of Catholics is very different. And I think that's something we have to note, is that what kind of humanity does the Catholic Church think it's talking to? Do they think they're talking to people like us? Do they think they're talking to the people where they basically run the government, which has been true in some places in South America through, well, a whole lot of historical fiat that I won't get into here? You know, it's very weird. And why tempt fate there? Why not just do the right thing? And I'm not saying do the right thing and give in. I'm not saying do the right thing and give the lady a job. I'm saying face the courts. Go have your day in court.
If you're so secure in your position that you have this religious protection and this religious right to fire a woman who's seeking IVF treatment, then go and present your case. It'll strengthen all your other next firings from here to eternity.
So, you know, we're talking about the United States, where we're forward thinking and very socially positive with, you know, returning to basically pre-Civil War times, or whether or not the Catholic Church has extrajudicial powers. So we should talk about those horrible backwaters where everybody's a fundamentalist and wants to murder people who disagree with them. You know, like Aleppo, Syria. Leaders of the self-ruled Jazeera province in northern Syria issued a 30-point decree declaring equal rights for women. The decree, which guarantees women's right to run for office, right to divorce, equal work, pay, and inheritance, is considered to be a rebuke of the regressive views of ISIS. The combined Kurdish-Arab ruling group in the province has attempted to claim their autonomy after the Syrian civil war and are currently fighting ISIS insurgents.
Wow, sounds really, really harsh, you know, like equal rights for women, run for office, right for divorce, equal pay and inheritance. I'm sure glad I live in the United States where, wait a minute. You know, it's one little shining light in the midst of, you know, what's been going on in Syria, the horrible civil war, the horrible takeover by, you know, Islamic State. And you have people that are fighting and saying, this is not what we stand for. We actually stand for, you know, these progressive values that treat humans as humans.
And this is something I've been following in the news a lot. Just, you know, on my own. And it's the political dialogue that's been going on in the Middle East since the Arab Spring has been really strange. You've got the let's kill everyone camp and the maybe not kill everyone camp and maybe let's just be nice to everybody camp. It's so weird that, I mean, you have the usual divides and the, you know, the borders are never as sharp as I'm making them out to be. They never are. But
certainly not in Mississippi.
That's kind of what it... I mean, when I read about... You know, when you read about the political back and forth in Egypt and Tunisia and stuff like that, that's what it feels like sometimes. Oh, who's in charge this time? Oh, it's the let's kill everybody party. Oh, boy. Well, they got ousted by the military. Oh, boy. But the, hey, let's be nice guys got in. Oh. Well, they got kicked out, too. Oh. So now it's the let's not kill everybody party.
Let's not kill everybody. Well, but, you know, just maybe some people.
Well, I guess it's a happy medium. I don't know.
Well, and the thing here that's really uplifting for me, actually, is that this is not a religiously motivated, you know, move on people. This is fighting religious fundamentalism. This is fighting the religious stronghold of these particular things taking away rights.
Absolutely. We have some people to thank. I'd like to thank David from Honolulu, Rick from Elma, Washington, and Candace from Bremerton, Washington, who writes, last week I was actually glad to hear about all the behind-the-scenes work you do to produce the show. Sometimes when you do your job so well, it can seem simple to those on the outside. I look forward to listening to the show each week, so I'm glad to contribute when I can. Thank you, all three of you, for contributing to Peggy's Challenge, which is Peggy from Kent's Challenge to the listeners of Ask an Atheist to help us keep the lights on. If you'd like to contribute to Peggy's Challenge, you can go to askanatheist.tv, click on the yellow button on the right-hand side, and it'll take you right to our PayPal page. There's a lot of a lot of stuff that goes beyond the scenes that, you don't see very much, but, it does mean something.
It does.
And it's nice to hear, especially these days. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC. That's 844-753-7842. We're gonna go over a break, and when we come back, we're gonna be interviewing Dr. Anthony Pinn. It's a really interesting interview. Please stick around.
Imagine tropical waters, warm sandy beaches, friendly people, incredible weather. The English-speaking Caribbean island nation of St. Lucia awaits. Don Summers and his team at Professional Realty Group are ready to assist you. Whether you're looking for an investment, a place to retire, or a killer vacation property, St. Lucia has homes in all price ranges starting at $110,000. Call Don at 780-237-4718 and check out dndrealty.ca.
The Humanists of Washington is the oldest humanist organization in the state and offers a community of free thinkers who educate the public and celebrate life. Come celebrate life with us. Humanists support intellectual freedom and critical thinking and hold that human beings are autonomous centers of moral development. You can become a member of the Humanists of Washington at humanistsofwashington.org. You'll get our quarterly publication, The Secular Humanist Press. Check out meetup.com where you can be part of our monthly Seattle dinner and our Heathens Do It Better breakfast. Humanists of Washington.
Need a break from the theistic world?
Live in the Seattle area?
Like the Flying Spaghetti Monster?
Whether you're an ardent non-believer, steadfast agnostic, or marauding Pastafarian, check out the award-winning nonprofit organization Seattle Atheists.
Socialize at the third Thursday meetup, attend lectures, come camping, donate blood.
Connect at seattleatheists.org.
Seattle Atheists, we believe in you.
Billy, I'm a certified ghost expert.
Wow, that's so credible.
Billy, your great-great-grandmother says she loves you and to give me your lunch money.
Aw, anything for family. Here you go.
Wait, Billy. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Come to Camp Quest Northwest, where you'll learn critical thinking and science in a fun-filled, week-long nature camp.
No!
Camp Quest Northwest can be found at campquestnorthwest.org. Donations and volunteers accepted. The devil is not real.
I know.
If you are a humanist, atheist, or freethinker from Everett, Washington to the Canadian border, Humanists of North Puget Sound welcomes you. Your freethought neighbors to the north have been promoting secular ideas for over 20 years. They're humanists, with a rational worldview informed by science, inspired by art, and motivated by compassion. Join up for monthly conversation, camaraderie, and activism. Humanists of North Puget Sound. Visit humanistsnps.org.
Dr. Anthony Pinn is a professor of religious studies at Rice University and the director of research for the Institute of Humanist Studies. He's with us today to talk about his newly published book, Everyday Humanism, which he co-edited with Dale McGowan. Welcome, Anthony.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about your book.
Well, this was our concern, that there's a great deal of information out concerning humanism, big ideas, but not as much information available concerning how one lives humanism. That is to say, not as much information related to the human and humanism. So Dale and I wanted to put together a book that helps folks think through the kind of impact humanism might have on everyday issues, things like charitable giving, health and well-being, education, just a variety of topics that we all encounter on a regular basis.
So you also had a book published last year called What is Humanism and Why Does It Matter? What are some of the major differences you see between that one and then Everyday Humanism?
Well, the first, What is Humanism and Why Does It Matter, was really about a wrestling with the definition of humanism, right? The title really says it all. We were trying to get a basic sense of what humanism might entail. If you pull away the layers of disagreement, what's left? And we also wanted to present that discussion within a historical context that made sense. And we wanted to do that also with some attention to a global audience. But again, the basic idea behind that first book was to get some clarity, to provide a way of thinking about the nature and meaning of humanism when you cut to its core. And this more recent book assumes a definition of humanism and then kind of works through the moral and ethical impact of humanism, the ways in which humanist values can guide everyday existence. Well, we wanted to wrestle with issues beyond the typical suspects, right? Science education, separation of church and state, these sorts of things, these huge issues, and kind of deal with how folks might live humanism within the context of their private lives.
There is such an incredible body of work to choose from. You work with so many different authors. And so how did you distill which choices to make, which authors to choose, which works to choose?
Well, Dell and I had a couple of exchanges by phone and then email, just kind of thinking through some of the folks who are doing really interesting work and who might be interested in what this project wanted to achieve. So we went back and forth on those names and came up with the list that represents this text, represents the table of contents. There's a lot of really interesting work being done, and there are folks that we didn't include, but you know, this is just the start of a conversation. It's not the last word. So we'll come back to this topic and include a different range of contributors.
So back to those topics, you have the book divided up into three sections. What are sort of those big main topics about how humanism is enacted in everyday life?
Well, we want to give some attention to how humanism functions with respect to the individual, and how humanism functions with respect to the individual in community, right? We want to recognize that people live within the context of social worlds, overlapping social worlds, that we function as individuals, and there are a range of issues that are represented through that context, but we also live in the context of relationships and community, and we wanted to give folks a way of thinking about issues on that level as well. And then we wanted to give folks a way of thinking through how humanism might function with respect to their relationship to larger communities, like nations.
So your specific contribution to the collection of essays focuses on the limits of charity. Can you kind of explain your perspective on this?
Here's my concern. I'm not suggesting that folks should not give. I'm suggesting that we really ought to rethink the impact of that giving. And this is what I have in mind, that giving is a wonderful thing, but giving is a Band-Aid, that giving to charitable organizations does little to change the systemic problems that produce poverty, for example. And so we ought to feel good about this charitable giving, but we should not fool ourselves into believing that charitable giving is the same as systemic change. Right. So we give what we can on that level, recognizing that changing the fundamental nature of life in the United States and elsewhere requires changes to institutions, not simply writing a check.
So if I can understand this right, charitable giving is an interesting Band-Aid, like charitable giving might be good in the case of a crisis response. But in order to solve more systemic problems, we have to look at something a little bit more fundamental.
Yes, exactly. That charitable giving is the start of a conversation. It's the start of change. It's not the end.
All right, cool.
What you say is exactly right, that when crisis occurs, we ought to do what we can to alleviate suffering. But we should not assume that alleviating suffering through cutting a check will change structures. That requires harder work.
All right.
So is there any areas that you were particularly attuned to when you were searching out, or areas that Dale McGowan was attuned to, or how did you decide on which areas that you wanted to focus on?
Well, we first looked at who might be a good fit for the project, right? So we went with who the contributors ought to be, and then looked at the expertise of those contributors. Rather than picking themes and trying to sandwich people into those, we went with the folks and played to their expertise. So we know that Chris Fedman, for example, is doing really interesting work on the relationship between theist and non-theist, religious and non-religious folks, right? Kind of exploring the ways in which interaction and collaboration between the two is a necessary formula for substantive change. So we picked him and then allowed him to play to his expertise.
One of the topics that it looks like wasn't explicitly addressed was mental wellness or behavioral health. And this seems to be a really hot topic for people that live non-religious lives. We have things like Recovering from Religion, the Secular Therapist Project. Are there plans in the future to maybe address that from a humanistic perspective?
Well, you're right. That's not explicitly addressed, although in giving attention to health and well-being, and this comes into play. But Dale and I, now that this book is finished, will have an opportunity to sit down and think through other possibilities. There's also a conversation that will take place with my board at the Institute for Humanist Studies, and we'll investigate what kind of issues need to be addressed next. And I think it's safe to assume that mental health will be one of those issues.
Back to a little bit the process between you and Dale and looking at expertise. Dale McGowan is one of the founders of Foundation Beyond Belief, which is specifically a monetary charity based, you know, giving structure. What was that conversation like when you were writing an essay about the limits of that kind of thing?
Well, our understanding is this, that there doesn't have to be agreement on everything. There's real benefit in conversation and the exchange of ideas. And so, again, my argument isn't that folks should stop giving. My argument is that effective change requires giving plus strategic challenge to systems, to organizations. So this really isn't a critique of what Dale is doing. It's a call for more, right? That we ought to be helping folks who are in need in the ways we can, but we also ought to be critiquing and reorganizing the structures, the fundamental structures of our lives. The political process needs to be thought through, for example, right? So I'm not suggesting we end our giving. Again, I'm suggesting that we understand the need to give and do more.
Okay. I definitely wouldn't have it any other way if there wasn't disagreement and sort of the exchange of ideas. You do have a question here. You do talk about political involvement in this book. And one of the things that you mentioned is that this is about everyday humanism. You know, we sometimes wrestle with questions of the separation of church and state and evolution and these big topics. And I find that in the context of humanism and atheism and skepticism, our interface with politics is generally on those very ideas. So I'm curious about how humanism interfaces with the local political sphere when these larger topics aren't necessarily at play.
Well, I think there's something to the idea that life is political in nature, right? That as we move through the world, as individuals and individuals in relationship, there are ways in which politics continue to impinge upon those relationships, right? So the political is always present. So it seems to me there are ways in which humanism and humanists of necessity are engaged in political process. As soon as we say we value life and that we understand the need to maintain the integrity of human existence, we are required to take on the political process to the extent, for example, it does damage to gays and lesbians, blacks, women, etc., that as soon as we say life matters, we've committed to political activism.
And I totally agree with this idea that, you know, we need to have these impacts, or we need to understand how politics impacts our daily lives as well as our more sort of larger societal things. But a lot of the stuff you talk about seems more directed towards U.S. politics. Is there enough that can engage people from maybe other countries, other cultures that don't necessarily deal with the exact same problems we in America are dealing with?
I think within these chapters, within the book as a whole, you get principles that are applicable beyond a particular cultural context, beyond a particular political context. So I think there's food for thought for folks outside of the context of the United States. But as director of research for the Institute for Humanist Studies, I have to also be mindful of the fact that our primary audience is U.S.-based.
Right.
Now, we want to be in conversation with folks elsewhere, but our primary audience, because of our location, is U.S.-based.
Speaking a little bit more about your audience, you know, this book really seems, it looks like, to resonate with a wide audience, but an earlier book of yours focuses on a much more specialized community. Can you tell us a little bit about your book, The End of God Talk, An African-American Humanist Theology?
Yes, most of my work has revolved around African-Americans. I've been concerned with the ways in which African-Americans represent and live humanism. My argument in The End of God Talk is this, that my training is in theology, and I'm arguing that theology is a system, it's a way of interpreting human experience that isn't owned by theists. I don't care about strict definitions of theology, which have never held. My argument is that religion is really about a quest for complex subjectivity. It's about making life meaningful, and theology becomes a tool. It becomes a tool for unpacking how people make life meaningful. And my argument is humanists do this just as theists do this. And so that book kind of explores the ways in which one might think about humanism as a system of meaning making and how it might be useful to explore that through the tool of theology. My work as director of research for the Institute of Humanist Studies of necessity has to extend beyond my own particular research interests. We have to speak to a larger audience than my personal research projects are obligated to speak to. My own work speaks to African-American humanism. But my argument would be this, that anyone concerned with humanism ought to be concerned with how humanism functions within a wide context. We shouldn't assume that all of the humanists are white. And so I would argue that folks have an obligation to learn something about the ways in which African Americans, Latinos, and others embrace and work through humanism.
Fantastic. If I can presage a comment I'm going to hear, I'm all for redefining terms to make sense in a modern context. So I'm with you on the word theology. But I believe you said the phrase complex subjectivity in this case, and I can already hear the email comments coming in on that one. Could you define that phrase out a little bit for us?
This is the argument for me. Complex subjectivity involves a recognition of our full humanity and a recognition that we are subjects of history, not objects of history. And as subjects of history, we live in various spaces simultaneously. So, for example, I'm a male. I'm African American. I'm middle class. I'm a university professor, and so on. I occupy all of those spaces simultaneously. And so my life as a subject of history, as a shaper of history, is complex. Hence, complex subjectivity.
So sort of an overlapping identity context as you go through various aspects of your life then.
Right. That our lives are rich, they're complex, they involve overlapping responsibilities, likes, dislikes, and I use this term complex subjectivity as a way of capturing all of that messiness, all of that layered stuff that is human life.
I like that.
I think one of the chapter headings back to everyday humanism that seemed to maybe touch on that was from a human-centered to a life-centered humanism. Would you say that encompasses that idea about those multiple contextual identities?
Well, yes and no. Yes, and that it's a push for understanding how the human exists within the context of a larger arrangement of life, yeah? A larger arrangement of life that extends well beyond who we are as human animals. But no, in that I don't want to lose a sense of how important it is to understand and wrestle with things like gender and race and sexual orientation and class. So I don't want to push beyond those too quickly to a general category of life. I think we need to linger over those social categories if we're going to have a positive impact on them.
Now, this is part of a series published by the Institute for Humanist Studies, or by Equinox Publishing. Is that correct?
Well, this book is with Equinox, but the Institute for Humanist Studies has a book series called Studies in Humanism and Atheism, and that's published through Palgrave Macmillan.
And so for sort of a casual reader or someone who wants to be a little bit more introspective, are there more sort of essays that you would recommend along this line of thinking, either within your own work or the Institute for Humanist Studies?
Well, I think listeners should certainly check out Everyday Humanism. We have another book that will be coming out in a month that I think will be of interest to listeners. It's a bit more focused. It's on theism and public policy. It's humanist responses to that relationship, and that's through Palgrave Macmillan. So I think those texts will be really, really helpful. They're also interesting texts that kind of explore the need for community, right? That is to say that humanism, so much of it has involved an effort to address these large policy issues, and we've given less attention to the need for community. That is to say, we've tried to get people out of theism, but we've not necessarily given them a soft place to land. And so I think the work by Greg Epstein and Chris Dedman kind of provide a way to think about a soft landing place for humanists. Those texts think through ways in which we can foster relationships that allow folks to be comfortable, to catch their breath as humanists.
It has been really, really fulfilling hearing this past, I would say, season or so, at least on Ask an Atheist, from people very dedicated to building that community, to having that soft landing space that you just talked about, and the different permutations that can take, whether it's with the Harvard humanists, as you said, Greg Epstein and Chris Dedman, or in all sorts of permutations like Sunday assemblies or other social gatherings. Mm-hmm. So it's been fulfilling to hear sort of that and to hear that echoed amongst a number of different works and different activists.
Yeah, I think those are a good start. Things like Houston Oasis and Sunday Assemblies, those are a good start. But this is my concern, that they are premised upon a church model, right? They're church light. They've taken away the theism and left the structure of ritual in place. And I would hope that as humanists and atheists, we can reach a point where we develop ways of being together that are more organic and aren't simply borrowed.
Right. Yeah, I definitely agree with you there. I mean, I people understand the church model. There's a lot of people who've left religion. A lot of people want nothing to do with it, but then there's another population of people who miss it. And maybe that provides a good, a good basis upon which to build a community, but it's a starting point. It's not the end point. At some point, we need to sort of move beyond that.
Exactly, exactly. It'll be hard work, but I think...
Yes.
I think we really need that. We really need something that is uniquely our own.
Yeah. So if people... I'm really enjoying this interview, but we do have to wrap up. If people would like to find you on the internet, where would I send them?
Folks should check out my website. It's anthonypenn.com. They can also follow me on Twitter. It's Anthony Penn. They can also email me. It's Penn, P-I-N-N, at rice.edu.
All right. And if people would like to find the book, Everyday Humanism, where would I send them?
Amazon will have it. Also, the Equinox website will carry it.
All right. Fantastic. We'll put a link on the website. Dr. Anthony Penn is a professor of religious studies at Rice University and the director of research for the Institute of Humanist Studies. We're talking about Everyday Humanism today, a book which he co-edited with Dale McGowan. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842, toll-free nationwide. We're going to go into a break. When we come back, Dan's going to give us a moment of science about drugs.
Looking to buy or sell a home or other property in Edmonton, Alberta, or surrounding areas? Demand a professional and call Don Summers of Professional Realty Group at 780-237-4718 or visit dndrealty.ca and discover how he works with you to achieve your goals, save you time, and protect your investment. Don Summers of Professional Realty Group. It's time you hired a professional.
I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Dorn, and we want to ask you an important question.
Are you sick and tired of other panel discussion shows wasting your time droning on and on about foreign policy, economics, and human rights?
Or do you want to hear conversations about things that actually matter?
We host a podcast called Radio Versus the Martians. Every month, we gather a panel of our nation's finest minds and plunge a rusty prison shank into the heart of tough questions that have an impact on the lives of real people like you.
Like, are drivers required to pull over for the Ghostbusters?
Is the United Federation of Planets actually an oppressive dictatorship run by guidance counselors?
Is Arnold Schwarzenegger secretly a genius?
And are we being mean when we laugh at movies that are so bad they're good?
So write your congressman and let them know that Radio vs. the Martians is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and on RadioVersusTheMartians.com.
Doyle's Public House is Tacoma's number one spot for the best selection of import brews and Irish whiskey.
Football matches and Red Sox games, knowledge night and no-cover live music.
Doyle's is your spot.
Check us out at doylespublichouse.com or stop by for a proper libation and soda bread at 2nd and St. Helens Avenue in Tacoma.
Like us on Facebook for all the latest updates and specials.
Doyle's in Tacoma.
2nd and St. Helens Avenue in Tacoma. doylespublichouse.com.
Maggie used to say, man, never stop fighting. Don't ever give up. And as I look out across this crowd right now, I'll tell you, I can see her face in every one of you. I can hear her voice every time you speak.
His name was Matthew Hoffman, the candidate. And though he didn't understand it now, years of inaction, deceit, and fear had formed a cancer. And now it would destroy him. AnnexRadio.com.
At Puget Sound Celebrant Service, we want to be your secular wedding officiant. We are committed to serving the Puget Sound region and work to ensure your special day is all about you. Robert, a certified humanist celebrant with the Humanist Society, specializes in secular weddings and customizes ceremonies to fit your needs. To commemorate your special day, each couple married by Robert will receive a one-year membership to the American Humanist Association. Find out more at PugetSoundCelebrant.com.
Welcome back. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC. That's 844-753-7842. Toll free nationwide. And now Dan with a moment of science.
Thank you, Sam. Today's moment of science is about drug resistance. No, not the minimally successful DARE program that we remember from grade school, but rather pathogens and parasites that have become resistant to the drugs that would otherwise be used to eliminate them. Antibiotics are a class of drugs that are useful for killing bacteria. Unfortunately, many people are not aware that antibiotics only work on bacteria and may pressure their doctors to prescribe them when they get the cold or the flu, both of which are viral infections against which antibiotics are useless. Not only are these drugs ineffective against viruses, but their overuse and misuse has led to some serious problems. Antibiotic drugs of the beta-lactam family inhibit a bacteria's ability to create its cell wall, thus stopping the bacteria from dividing and triggering a chain reaction that'll result in cell death. They've been one of our best tools against bacterial infections for decades, but their popularity has caused a dangerous enemy to evolve. You've probably heard of an infection called MRSA. If not, consider yourself lucky. MRSA consists of several strains of Staphylococcus aureus bacteria that have become completely resistant to beta-lactam drugs, hindering physicians and causing the agonizing deaths of thousands of people. Using antibiotics when they aren't needed or failing to take the entire recommended treatment gives the bacteria a chance to evolve into something new and terrifying. So if you've been prescribed antibiotics, follow the directions and take the entire course. Don't just stop taking them when you start to feel better. And if you haven't been prescribed antibiotics, don't ask for them. Of course, it isn't just bacteria that can become resistant to drug therapies. We have antiviral drugs as well. Just as antibiotics target bacteria, antivirals target viruses. There's a popular antiviral drug called Tamiflu, designed to battle the influenza viruses, but in recent years, certain strains of flu virus, most notably a strain of H1N1 or swine flu, have begun to show resistance to Tamiflu. This isn't just limited to one antiviral or one virus, and even antiretrovirals like those used to treat or prevent HIV infection are susceptible to evolving viruses. So for those using antivirals as their only form of protection from viral infections, please reconsider. You're helping to drive the evolution of nastier strains, strains that we may not be able to respond to anytime soon. I hope that I've made it clear so far that the misuse and overuse of antibiotic and antiviral medications is a very bad thing, and that it makes the world a more dangerous place for all of us. Please, please use them responsibly. That being said, there are a few more kinds of drug resistance out there. Antihelminthics are drugs that treat infections by parasitic worms. And while it's taken quite a while, there are now some strains of resistant nematode worms that infect our livestock. Resistance can also occur in cancer cells that have been exposed to chemotherapy. There are several different chemotherapy drugs that attack cancerous cells in different ways, but there are even more kinds of cancerous cells, and one of their hallmarks is rapid division and mutation. As a result, chemotherapy drugs tend to become less effective in the same patient after multiple treatment regimens. There's really no good way around this one except to keep producing novel drugs to try to keep up. In evolution, we see what's called the Red Queen hypothesis crop up again and again. It's a reference to Through the Looking Glass by Lewis Carroll, in which a Red Queen explains to Alice that, "Here, you see, it takes all the running you can do to keep in the same place." The analogy is used to describe relationships between predator and prey, host and parasite, and pathogen and host. In all cases, both sides are continuously evolving new ways to outdo one another. So remember that the next time someone suggests to you that the government or big pharma is secretly withholding a cure for cancer or AIDS, even if that were true, such a cure would only be effective for a short time anyway. Now go wash your hands.
If you have a scientific question or topic that you'd like to hear on the radio or the podcast, give us a call at 844-SKEPTIC or go to askanatheist.tv and click on the shiny red candy-like button.
I love it when we talk about evolution on A Moment of Science. There's just so many areas of our life and our existence that really is impacted by this particular principle that is observable in science, and to completely reject evolution would completely reject the way that drugs work, that the mechanisms of how we get sick, how we get well, all those kinds of things. So it's always refreshing to hear all those new ways in which evolution actually matters to us and our existence.
Dan, I'm going to provide you a moment to judge me.
Sure.
I don't know if you've noticed in the corner of the studio here, I have a black computer. It's a Macintosh TV. It's the first Macintosh that actually did a TV. It had TV stuff in it. It's the first Mac with a TV tuner in it. It was $10,000 when it hit the market, and I saw it at Best Buy every day when I was in junior high, and fell in love with it, even though it was kind of a crap computer. Then I found an opportunity to get one on Craigslist, a million years ago. And I had to trade for it. So I brought a bunch of stuff to this guy's house, and we did a trading session in his home. And he mentioned halfway through that he had just kicked MRSA while I'm in his house. And he wasn't sure where he got it from. And so it's like, okay, on the way home, I'm like, okay. So Becky basically made me HIPAA cleanse and shower outside and clean off all the equipment before I was allowed in the house. Was that a smart thing to do?
That actually might have been a bit of an overreaction. MRSA
from Becky? No way.
MRSA,
and we're talking community-acquired MRSA in this case, right? Which is one of the newer ones that's been popping up.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and we're finding it in our municipal waterways and things, too. Not in the drinking water, I should point that out, but in our sewage and storm water. It's starting to show up. Some strains are hypothesized to be carried by fish or birds. I mean, Staphylococcus aureus is a huge group of different strains of bacteria.
Okay.
Usually when you... If you're going to worry about MRSA, it's typically a post-surgical infection.
Mm-hmm.
If you get something that has MRSA in it on your skin and your skin is not cut or abraded, you probably don't really need to worry.
Okay.
If you get something with MRSA sprayed in your eyes, you have a problem.
So
or sprayed in an open wound, or you snorted up your nose, you may have an issue. But the point is, Staphylococcus aureus bacteria are around us all the time. There's some on my skin right now. There's some in my throat right now. There's some in my eyes right now.
Some on the microphone.
They're just around.
Ooh.
But the problem is when an infection gets out of control, because the infection is the clinical state. That's when these bacteria become dangerous. They're right on us all the time. When an infection gets out of control, those that have this resistance, these MRSA bacteria, cannot be combated with regular antibiotics. And that's what makes them dangerous, is that our normal response to an infection, not our immune response, but our clinical response, doesn't work.
So all of this science and evidence and actual useful data aside, let's get to the heart of the matter. Should I be judged for what I have done or not?
For showering outside when
in the middle of winter with computers,
I would say maybe Becky should be judged for that one. that might have been some unnecessary unpleasantness you didn't have to put him through.
Well, it functions
well,
great.
Yeah. So. It wasn't the first and won't be the last. So yeah.
You know, if I
and
had
germaphobes, will tell you can't be too careful.
If I had to pick between HIPAA cleansing and showering outside and paying $10,000 for that computer, I'll go for the outside shower, even if it's winter, which it was at the time.
So everybody won.
Yeah, everybody won.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good deal.
And it's a fantastic TV that no longer gets TV stations because it's before the digital switchover. Anyway, fun times. Ask me about retro computing sometime, please. Somebody ask me. anyway, we have an event coming up. Becky, why don't you tell us about it?
Sure. The Humanists of Washington and Seattle Atheists are hosting our annual Solstice Potluck Dinner on December 7th. And you can find out more information by going to meetup.com and looking for Secular South Sound. So Humanists of Washington, Secular South Sound, or Secular Seattle, or Seattle Atheists. And there's a place where you can RSVP there through any of those meetups. And in the past, you know, it's been a really great way for people to connect. And for people in the free thought community around Seattle and greater Seattle, you know, we have people coming from as far away as Olympia, as far north as Everett, and it's a really nice time.
Yeah. And if you want to help me out in the kitchen, I could definitely use it this year.
That's where Sam hides out. I'm usually at the kids' table, and lots of different folks from Ask an Atheist and our greater community are usually there.
Yeah, and it's one of the events where people who listen to the show in the area come and talk to me. So naturally, I hide in the kitchen the entire time. I don't know what's with me, but that is something I do, I guess.
It's one of the times where people will say, huh, you don't look like how I thought you'd sound.
That is the weirdest thing you can get. I mean, I've heard people say that, you know, just because of the stuff I do with radio, I've heard people say that a lot. And now I'm getting it for the first time. Wow, you sound nothing like you look. And I'm like,
what does that mean?
What does that mean?
How
what were you expecting?
To look?
Apparently a lot thinner.
Oh, okay. I was expecting Mitch Hedberg moonlighting as a Sasquatch potato man.
Okay. That's clearly a reference to something, isn't it?
Nah,
something in Dan Bartus' head.
All right.
I'm afraid
maybe,
that was on
maybe
the fly.
It should be a reference.
Man,
there is so much news that we could be talking about. I recently, if you follow the blog or our Facebook page or our Twitter or our Tumblr or, you know, any of our social media stuff, I recently emailed Derek Kilmer, my representative, about him voting down atheist chaplains in 2013. I got a response this week. It's not a good one. And you'll be seeing it on the website this week. There's weirdness going on in Everett. There's a whole lot of stuff we should be talking about, but I want to focus on something good as we come to the top of the hour. The newly formed Mid-Columbia Coalition of Reason has announced its launch with a series of bus ads in the Tri-Cities area of Eastern Washington. The campaign includes 6 billboards on local buses featuring the statement, "Don't believe in God? You're not alone." Mid-Columbia Coalition of Reason is an organization of 6 local non-theist groups. The ads were paid for by the United Coalition of Reason, who have placed similar ads in 37 states and the District of Columbia. So far, there have been no reports of vandalism or complaints. Good news.
It is good news. I love when we hear about a new launch of the Coalition of Reason, that outreach campaign saying, hey, look, there's, you know, about 20% of our United States populace that doesn't have a particular religious affiliation. You might be an atheist. And if you are one, if you don't believe in God, you're not alone. Some of my favorite things, actually, was about a year and a half ago, we were down in California, and they had told us in the Sacramento area when they had done this that there were a few defaced billboards.
Yeah.
And, of course, our local news had inquired with the local pastor about what he thought of the, you know, defacing of atheist billboards. And he said, well, I don't know. I don't see any Christians out there, but I sure do see a lot of cows, somehow insinuating that cows had defaced an atheist billboard.
Interesting thought. Cows are not Christians.
You know, there is sort of a history or some sort of precedent of cows as defacers of billboards, as anyone who might be familiar with the Chick-fil-A ad campaigns. So
as little
you might
as
have
I
been
try
making
to...
some kind of a reference there.
Oh, that would be weird.
Eat more chicken?
Yeah, where the cows are up on the billboard spray painting it to say eat more chicken.
Yeah, and the cows are working
wrong
with Chick-fil-A, who clearly don't like atheists. So there's sort of a collusion. Yeah.
And in all fairness,
maybe cows are Christian.
Yeah, those may be Christian cows. Yeah.
Christian cows.
They may be. But, you know, it is really cool to hear of the Coalition of Reason in sort of the Tri-Cities area, this mid-Columbia, Columbia being our river that goes through our state.
Yeah, I can already hear my fellow grumpy atheists saying, well, one, you know, bus ads. No, this is important. This is how, every time we do something public, we always get a few more people who didn't know we were out there. Witness what happened to us in August when we faced the Pierce County Council for the second time. The other thing is it also serves as a barometer. It tells us something about the region when these signs go up. They go up in Sacramento, they get defaced. They go up on the east side of Washington, they don't, which surprises me, to be honest with you.
That is actually kind of surprising.
From everything that I've been told about the area, you know, there's some great people doing some great stuff out there. And I'm really glad to see that they're getting some attention and deserved attention and that they're working together. I mean, it's a fantastic thing to see.
I know when the Coalition of Reason here, Northwest Coalition of Reason, had it, we just had our billboard that stayed up for about 2 weeks and that was it.
Yeah. Yeah, which is, you know, I mean, Seattle. I wonder how it would go if it were down here in Tacoma.
Not Lake City Way in North Seattle?
Yeah, I don't know what to say. But that's all the time we've got for this week. My name is Sam Mulvey. With me was Dan Lombardo and Rebecca Friedman. And Dave Roulette helped us out in the interview. I am still the producer. You can go to askanatheist.tv. Leave us a voicemail at 844-753-7842. Or email us at questions@askanatheist.tv. See you guys next week.